Those of you who've been coming regularly know that since September 11th, I've been trying to know what to say when I come here Sunday mornings. It hasn't always been easy to figure out what kind of response, or how to talk about it, and how to talk about it in a large group like we are. And yesterday afternoon, I started thinking about what I was going to talk about today. And I was as perplexed is the right word, but as perplexed as usual. And so I went to sit instead of thinking about what I was going to talk about. And I sat longer than I was anticipating. I just sat and was kind of absorbed in my meditation and put the idea of a talk out of my mind. And when my meditation came to an end, it was clear to me that I wanted to talk about listening. And I trust somehow that that topic is popped up out of me, because through the sitting, I had gotten still enough, very quiet, kind of gotten out on my own way, that to allow some deeper wellspring of understanding, of intuition, to kind of pop up. And somehow that's what came up. And the topic of listening and not being self-centered, and how the two are go together in a very important way. I was perhaps a little bit stimulated in this topic by having read earlier an interview with Thich Nhat Hanh, titled something like "If I Was Going to Go Speak with Osama Bin Laden." And so the interviewer asks him, "What would you do if you went to, if you had the chance to go interview Bin Laden?" And Thich Nhat Hanh says that the most important thing he would do at first would be to just listen. And he said it would be very hard. Basically, he said it would be very hard for me to listen, but I have to prepare myself and be really strong, so that I can just really listen and not get reactive. And I'd bring with me all kinds of good friends who are really good at listening also, because I don't know if I can do it on my own. But together, and then we would just listen, hear, try to understand. In an interview, he kept saying that there's no compassion without understanding. So he said, I would just listen for a long time. And then he said, then my friends and I would go away, go off someplace, and just sit and be quiet and try to come to terms with their reactivity. Because I think he imagined that whatever he heard, a lot of things he'd heard, would probably make him angry or upset or fearful or something. And he didn't want to respond to the other, to Bin Laden, with those kinds of reactions. So him and his friends would take themselves out of the situation and breathe and calm themselves down. And then they'd go back, he said, and then assuming the other party wanted to listen, point by point, explain to them their misunderstanding, where they've misunderstood something. And what I liked very much about what he said was the importance of listening. And I've seen many times in my own life that listening is one of the primary ways of overcoming hostility, if we can learn to listen carefully. Some years ago at Spirit Rock, the Spirit Rock Teachers Council, which is a group of about 14 people, and the Spirit Rock board and some of the staff people, invited a couple up to Spirit Rock to train Spirit Rock community in a system of meeting together, consulting with each other, listening to each other, called council. And it was a couple named Jack and Jacqueline Zimmerman who wrote a little book on the topic. And they had studied how to sit in a circle that many different groups around the world have done, but particularly the Native Americans, and had evolved over many years a kind of procedures for how to hold a council. People sit in a circle. And they felt that it's a much more effective way of decision making in certain, for a community of equals, community of people who want to participate together. than hierarchical decision making or the various other ways you might meet. And so they came to Sparrow Rock to train us in this system of counsel. And it took a little bit of training. There were certain ground rules that they had to know. One of them was, but the primary thing, and the primary ground rule is listening. You sit in a circle and everybody has a chance to speak in their own turn. And then 99.9% of your time during the day, you're just listening to other people. Because if you're one of 30 or 40, 50 people, you don't speak that often. So that seemed, pretty obvious, that it's useful to listen and listen deeply. And the other ground rule was, there's different ways of talking in council. And one way of talking, you just simply go around the circle. And the next person talks, the next person talks. And one of the ground rules was, you're not supposed to prepare what you're going to say, which was very hard for a lot of people. And the reason for that was given was, if you prepare, you're not listening to the person who's speaking ahead of you. And you really what you want to do is listen. Also, if you prepare, then you don't allow for some deeper wellspring within you to pop up, so you're surprised even by what you say. If we prepare, sometimes it may be wise to prepare, and sometimes we prepare so that we look good. And if we're looking good and trying to present ourselves a certain way, then some of our deeper feelings, our deeper connection to the topic, maybe doesn't have a chance to bubble up. So no preparing, just listening. And then another ground rule, which I found very interesting, was if someone else has said what you were going to say, someone said it before you, there's no need to say it again. And that was very hard for some people, because, oh, that's my idea. It's important people see me having that idea. But the understanding is that counsel is kind of like an organism or a group mind that's being created there. And many people come to that kind of situation perhaps as individuals. And what's important for them is their self-centered view. I'm an individual. What my opinions are is important. How I am seen by other people is important. My ideas are important, and people should see what is my own. And it's my ideas in opposition to other people's ideas or whatever. But the idea in the council is that it's a group mind that's operating. I don't know, maybe there's a better word for it. But the council is an organism in its own. It has its own process that's going on that is not any one individual person's process. And by coming into the council, you're participating in this group mind process, this collective process. And it's the collective sense of the meeting, the collective group mind that's arising, that's important, not any one individual person standing out as being the brilliant carrier of this particular idea, one particular idea. So if someone's already said what you might want to say, then you don't know you need to say that. And it might not even be necessary to say, I have the same idea. And I'm not going to tell you what it is, but the same as the person next to me or whatever. Because that's already been put into the circle. It's been already put into the group mind, and it sits there. And what I saw, at Spirit Rock, we were trained in this, and then we've adopted it at Spirit Rock as kind of the default, or not default, or the primary way in which to conduct large meetings. The teachers always sit in a circle, and when there's teacher, board, staff meetings, we sit in a circle, and we try to do this council system. And what I've seen in the number of times I've participated in this is the way that a group of people, including myself as part of a group, will shift slowly in the course of the meeting. We're listening to each other, taking each other in, speaking what we feel we need to speak. And there's this kind of often this miraculous sense of this shift and change that is different than some kind of linear progression. You're going to argue a point out. And because when you talk in a circle, it's not... Your turn to speak doesn't necessarily building on the person before you. If there's a discussion back and forth, two people talking, they kind of build, hopefully, on each other and respond to each other. But in counsel, you're responding to the sense of the group. You're responding to the whole thing, not just to what the person said ahead of you. And so there's a wonderful process of change and transformation that can happen, that at the end of a day of this, some decision can sometimes occur that kind of bubbles up in the group, rather than some decision that was hammered out because all the points were kind of in some linear way discussed. So one of the aspects of counsel then is not being self-centered in the process, in a sense being group-centered. And group-centered doesn't mean that you have no voice. Everyone has an equal voice and everyone has a very important voice. But it's not a self-centered voice. And we learn it's a voice that gets spoken by also listening to other people very carefully. And also being listened to very carefully. It's very transformative to have other people listen to you and really feel like you've been heard, especially in times of great distress or difficulty. One of the things that touched me the last few weeks was one of our Sangha members was in Germany on September 11th. And he told me that he said that American press has not publicized very much the reaction abroad to September 11th. And he said that within hours of the hijackings, that all the flags in Germany were in half-mast, and people were Germans were starting putting flowers on, you know, on American embassy steps and you know, steps of cathedrals and churches and opening their churches up. And within a few days, there was a kind of march in solidarity with America in Berlin that drew 250,000 people. And I was very touched when I heard this, because you know, it's one thing to be involved in your own tragedy, but to be able to hear enough, listen that someone else is actually hears you and feels you and feels compassion for you or connected to you in it, is very powerful. And to feel that it's outside of your own family, to feel you're outside your own tribe, I felt myself kind of softening you know, towards this wider global community we're in. And I've heard that in other places in Europe there are also big, you know, responses like that. And when I hadn't heard about those kinds of responses, it was very easy for me just to kind of think it was kind of like a, you know, it's like local thing. It's like us in America, my tribe, versus some other tribe over there in the Middle East or somewhere. And to feel the global connection was, and to hear that was very important for me. And then listening in this process of counseling. What I'm going to say now is probably maybe only peculiar to me, kind of peculiar ideology or idea. It has to do with democracy. I think of democracy as kind of like a big council. I think of history as being this pendulum of different forces balancing each other out and finding their way forward. And until I had this idea, I had the notion that in American democracy, it was kind of like me against them. Me, you know, what my opinions were and what I stood for against those people over there who had different points of view. And we was a great battle between me and them. Democrats versus Republicans, conservatives or liberals or whatever it might be. And it was kind of like in black and white terms, as if the other is completely wrong and I'm completely right. Now, I've been humbled many times to realize that some of my opinions through time have not been very well considered and often been wrong or misinformed or not, you know, the wisest thing. And I've also been humbled to realize that people who I was critical of before had some good ideas and maybe saw things in a different way. And so I think, you know, democracy works a little bit, you know, people voting against each other or the counter votes and whatever. But if you think of it, I think of it now more as this group process, this group mind, where it's not me against them, but it's all of us together coming together to create something new. And that I'm part of, participant in that, and my vote is very important. Someone else's vote is very important. They might have a different opinion than me. I might even think they're wrong. But their point of view is very important for the overall collective process to occur. So there was a Vipassana teachers meeting some years ago, in the 80s, at a time when Vipassana, Western Vipassana teachers were kind of young, new teachers, and struggling to figure out how to teach in America. And there was much more conflict within the teacher community than there is now. Now it's a pretty harmonious community. And they had one meeting that it's been kind of legendary. It's talked about a lot, where a lot of the tension in the community was present at this teacher meeting. And there was a facilitator. The facilitator asked one of the teachers, part of the tension was between the conservative wing and the liberal wing of Vipassana teachers. The conservative wings that wanted to stick to the true Dharma, you know, how it really is, and how it was taught in Asia, and, you know, a little bit more the fundamentalist type, perhaps. And the liberal type was the one who wanted to do away with all the rituals and all the traditional forms and wanted to be involved in engaged Buddhism and, you know, make it relevant for the rest of the world. And something like that. And so these people, like those two camps, there was like two people who represented the polar opposites of these points, and there was people in between. And it was very tense, apparently. So the facilitator asked first the polar liberal to leave the room. And so the person left the room, left the group, the circle. And then the facilitator says, now that person, imagine that person now is gone from our community, from the teacher community. How would that affect the rest of you? And the teachers who were left said, oh, we would all shift a little bit to the left because he carries a very important voice for us. And it's very important to have that point of view. And if he wasn't holding it for us, we'd all feel necessary to kind of shift a little bit over to kind of hold that little bit. And so then the person came back in, and then the polar conservative was sent out of the room. And the same thing was asked then. How would that affect you if that person wasn't part of the teaching community? And they said, oh, we would shift a little bit more to the conservative side, because it's really important to have that included as part of the package, as part of the whole thing. And so the idea of a package, the idea of a package, rather than one view or one point of view as being the one thing, there's a diversity of the views. And it's a package which is important, and it's the way in which a package kind of, all the pieces in the package bounce off each other and relate to each other, that creates something very different, and maybe hopefully more healthy than if someone holds on to their own individual point of view. When I was about 20 or 21, I lived in a spiritual community, spiritual commune called The Farm in Tennessee. And it was Stephen Gaskin who was came out of the Haight-Ashbury days. His three primary spiritual teachers was his Marine Corps drill sergeant, Suzuki Roshi, who was a Zen teacher in San Francisco then, and LSD. And so it was an interesting combination. And he left San Francisco on tour and took with him a huge caravan of hippies and school buses. And eventually they settled in Tennessee. And when I got there, there were 800 people in this very big commune. And I'd never really been in any kind of spiritual community before. But this was a spiritual community that was based originally on acid. But that didn't really work in Tennessee so well. And so rather than being LSD, it became truth-telling. And they came to the idea that telling the truth was as powerful as taking acid. And I was so struck by the power of truth-telling in this community that I stayed for a while. And I felt very happy there because it felt very homogenous. I was just another middle-class white hippie, back to the earth kind of hippie, and working on the farm. And it was really great for a few months. And after a while, I started getting uncomfortable there because everyone was exactly the same, almost. I mean, it seemed like everyone had the same views as me. I felt like I'd found like the great deal utopia. And I started getting uncomfortable because I said, where are the other points of view? And I didn't want to be anymore in a place where everyone agreed with me. I wanted to be in a place where there's different points of view so that I could bounce off and be changed and be affected by that. From a little different angle then, about 20 years ago I was working at a restaurant, and I think it was end of my shift, and I was in the changing area, changing to leave, and some guy was going to start his shift, and he came into the changing room, and he was kind of a friend of mine. We had a nice jovial relationship, and he stepped into the room to change, and I immediately, without, you know, kind of pausing, I just saw him. I immediately kind of launched forth in kind of a joke or kind of a little jovial kind of exchange. And he walked into the room, and then I noticed that, you know, he was kind of in a heavy mood. And it turned out that one of his best friends had just died. And I was a little bit mortified or upset by myself that I hadn't taken the time to notice who he was, what was going on with him, before I launched forth with my little thing. And I felt kind of chastised by this, that before, you know, talking to someone, maybe you should listen to them first, or maybe you should just take them in first, not rush in with my little point of view. And I've tried since then not to do that, not always so successful. I've tried since then to kind of hang out with someone first, kind of get a sense of them before I speak to them about anything, because I want to find out where they're at, what's going on with them. To listen, to learn to listen. This is one of the synonyms for mindfulness in my lexicon. There's a number of synonyms for mindfulness. One of them is truth-telling, but the other is listening, learning to listen to ourselves. And I know when I sit down to meditate that it's a process of listening to what's going on for me. And listening is a beautiful quality. It's a beautiful synonym for mindfulness, because if you look at something, it's easy to avert your eyes, to turn away, or close your eyes. It's a little bit harder to do that with your ears. Of course, you can plug up your ears. But your ears, you can't close your ears in the same way so easily. The ears are kind of open panoramically. You can't turn away and expect not to hear. And there's something about listening then, which is also uninterfering. When you listen to something, I think you can easily discern the difference between hearing the sound and the opinions and ideas and reaction you have to the sound or what's being said. So to listen to yourself, as a description of meditation, is to learn how to be present for what's going on within you without being evaluative or judgmental or reactive to what you're listening to. Just to listen. And I still find it kind of a miraculous process to sit down to meditate. Because sometimes I'll sit down and there's all this whirl of surface chatter that goes on. All these, you know, my desires, you know, rushing off in many different directions, wanting, you know, if I sit down, I can no longer rush after the things that I'm doing, but my mind is still rushing after ideas and memories and plans and all these different things going on. And one of the things I can listen to when I stop and meditate is how exhausting and tiring it is for the mind to be racing around like that, to be so actively involved or reactive. The reactive mind is exhausting. And just listening to it, just listening to that mind, not trying to make it go away, will often just let it relax by itself. It's part of the miracle, I think, of awareness, is awareness will let things relax, often, the self-liberating quality of mindfulness. And then once the surface chatter has settled away, then there's a listening to some deeper part of myself inside, which, as it gets deeper and deeper, seems less and less personal, or seems less and less that it's me, or less and less related to how I define myself. The surface mind is often fueled by, in some degree or other, our self-centeredness. Not necessarily in a bad way, self-centered, but self-centered in that, you know, it's my ideas, what's in it for me, how this affects me. As that kind of concern for defining ourselves or getting something for myself settles in the mind, and the mind is no longer being driven by that, then there's a chance to listen to some deeper wellsprings within us, which is not self-centered, but is still part of who we are. And for me, this is a very important distinction between being self-centered and discovering wellsprings within us, within ourselves, which is not self-centered. Maybe in the logic of the words, it sounds like, you know, if you're not self-centered, you're not going to be with yourself. My suggestion is being self-centered is a particular way of being with yourself that involves some kind of contraction around some definition of self, some protection of self, some And when that contraction is longer there, you can still be with yourself. And the miracle that occurs is that these other wellsprings, these other sources and streams within us have a chance to bubble up, that often don't have a chance to bubble up when we're self-centered. So in the same way, as in the council system, we learn to listen and let go of our self-centered concern to prepare for the what's next. When we sit and meditate, we do the same thing for ourselves. It's kind of like when we sit and meditate, there's a council of voices within ourselves, and we learn to listen to them all, and in listening to them all and letting them all relax, then something that is not self-centered occurs. So, you know, how do you guys listen? One of the interesting things to be mindful of is the process by which you listen to things. What is the quality of your listening? What fuels or what influences the way that you listen? How often when you listen are you involved with judging and evaluating what you're listening to? If you're doing that, to what degree are you evaluating it against your own opinions? Or what's in it for you? And how much are you willing to let that kind of fall away temporarily so you can really listen and take in the other person as deeply and carefully as possible, what's being said? I don't know, but it's a very interesting thing to study. How is it that you listen? And to look in different situations in your life, over a dinner table with your family if you live with some people, or over lunch table at work, or at meetings you go to, or in Dharma talks you come to, or in talking with friends or whatever. What are some of the things that influence the way that you listen? What goes on in your mind when you're listening? Are you really listening to the other person? Or is it your opinion more important than what the other person has to say? I know that's been my case sometimes. I'm rushing ahead. I'm ready to, you know, I'm hoping the person will stop talking so that, you know, I can get my opinion in. Because, you know, my opinion, you know, that's what else is important in the world. And it's been very, very instructive for me in my role as a meditation teacher when I meet with people one-on-one, because it's a time where I try to be mindful. And it often occurs to me I'm listening to someone and they're halfway through saying what they're going to say, and I'm already formulated a response. I know what advice to give or what point of view to say or whatever, you know. And so I try not to rush in. I try not to say right away what I wanted to say. And so many times I learned that if I don't do that, but wait and let the person keep talking, that I discover new things about the person that I wouldn't have discovered if I had interrupted or said what I wanted. Or what I also find out is that there's a lot of wisdom in the other person. And if the person gets a chance to speak, sometimes they come to the same conclusions themselves. And this principle goes one step further. Rather than rushing into with my ideas, it's often useful to ask questions of the person. And hopefully they're not too, if they're leading questions, they can be obnoxious. But to keep the process of listening going by asking good questions of the person. And then something else can bubble up that might have been very different than if I had rushed in with my opinion. I'm struck how often in doing this that in that process better ideas come up than my own ideas that I was so, you know, sure were, you know, the right thing to say. So listening is a very fascinating process. To really listen well requires us to give up control. To give up control of knowing what the outcome is going to be. Knowing what the right response is going to be. Knowing where we stand necessarily in the process while we're listening. Where we stand might arise after we listen. But while we're listening, we have to give up some control. We don't know where the person is going to go. And it's kind of like allowing ourselves to enter into something which is unknown. And some people have a very hard time giving up control. And that, I believe that's why some people have trouble really listening deeply. So again, to go back to the lessons that I get from my own meditation, It's also very instructive for me to compare how I listen or how I want to speak before I meditate and how I am afterwards. Like especially if I've had a busy day and done a lot of different things. And I get a little bit speedy or a little bit fast. My mind is kind of in its all its concerns or whatever. And my self-centeredness is much more likely to come into play then. And so if I'm talking to someone, the kind of speedy mind, the surface mind, is ready to kind of rush off with ideas, opinions, with interruptions, with taking offense, with taking receiving praise, receiving blame, reacting to all those things. If I watch myself after I've meditated for some time, and the surface mind, surface reactivity has kind of settled and quieted, I'll engage in the same conversation radically different. As to me, it's like sometimes like difference between night and day. And if I'm really settled and relaxed and the surface mind is not operating, then I'm much more open to listening, I'm much more open to the unknown, I'm much more contented with how things are, and I don't feel like I have to rush in to kind of say what I need to say. Before I sit, discontent will influence how I listen and how I talk. After I sit, contentment will influence how I talk and how I listen. Someone who hasn't done something like meditation might not recognize the difference between these different states. So if you're discontented or irritated or feeling vulnerable or feeling threatened by life or whatever, there can be a strong tendency to think, well, this is the way it is. This is the filter through which I'm going to see and hear the world around me. And we accept this is the way it has to be. You know, this is the true way. This is the true perception. Or, you know, this is my opinion, you know, is believable. But to be able to shift and see the shift at the end of meditation and see there's actually a very different way of being present is very instructive in learning, oh, maybe when I'm being discontented or irritated, that's only one point of view. And I've gone back and forth like this so much that now sometimes when I'm in a particular point of view, a particular mood, I'll be much more cognizant of that mood and aware that it's a filter by which I'm seeing and experiencing the world. And I'll try to listen. I can't necessarily get rid of the mood so quickly, but I'll try to kind of look around the edges of those glasses or not to believe those glasses automatically. So hopefully that was clear. So the process of learning to listen, I think, is really central to, I believe, is central to a spiritual practice. And the process of not being self-centered is also very central to a spiritual practice and also to listening. And when we listen to ourselves in meditation, it's really helpful to let there be a lot of pauses, a lot of stillness. When we listen to other people in conversation, it's really helpful if we are willing to let there be some silence, some quiet in the conversation. And I'll end with a story of when I met the Evansons, the people who are going to who are selling us their church in Redwood City. I talked to them many times on the phone, and the first time I met them in person was at the viewing of the church at the beginning of September, right? Whenever it was. And I arranged to meet them there early, so it would just be the three of us, I mean, before the group came to look at the church. So I was there about an hour early. And it was very lovely to meet them finally, and I felt very close to them because of the phone conversations. And it was very warm, and they started showing me the church and giving me kind of a personal tour of the church. And as the conversation proceeded, there were longer gaps. And then we'd talk for a while, and there'd be kind of a longer pause. It was very, very sweet, the pause and the silence. And then got longer. And finally we found ourselves sitting in the sanctuary on the pews. And there was a long pause, and I realized there was no need to carry on the conversation. And that what was most pregnant, what was most powerful, what was most significant, was the fact that the three of us were sitting together in silence in this sanctuary together. And so then I went and meditated and sat with them, meditated, mindful. And it was the most inspiring and most precious part of meeting them was not the conversation we had, but having this wonderful trust of each other, that we could sit together there, very intimate, very feeling very connected to each other, and not having to speak, kind of sharing that ability to be silent. So when we listen, we can listen to more than just the words. So those are my thoughts for today. Now I'm ready to listen. We have about 5 minutes.
That's what's really important is hearing. On the other hand, I've found that there's been times, and this just occurred just recently, where I've been in a situation where I'm like the lone voice, and I don't feel heard at all. And a lot of times this occurs via email, which I really hate. I mean, I don't think you can really hear well right via email. But and I find myself thinking, you know, that people need to hear me, and that there's a certain level of frustration. And I was told just recently that, oh, it's not that we didn't hear you, we just didn't agree. And I thought, you know, I didn't feel heard. And I felt like I was basically being told, look, you know, you were outvoted. And it was really, and the whole situation was about how we were treating someone, and I felt that we were not treating this person correctly. So it was actually something that I was pretty connected to. It wasn't like being outvoted on, we chose this picture over that picture or something like that. So I felt like that authority was used to deal with the situation rather than listening. And yet, you know, I kept stepping back and thinking, well, have I heard what they're saying? Well, I kind of have, but I don't know. I'm just, you know, to me it feels entwined with control and authority.
Yeah. It's very, very, very. You know, we live in a complex world. Just a little footnote to what you said. I'm finding more and more that email messages lack a lot of the context for what people are saying. So sometimes it's really easy, I find, for misunderstanding the tone of the email. It's not so clear. You know, is this person angry or is this person joking? Or is this person, you know, what's going on here? And I'm left scratching my head. You know, what is this? What's behind this message here? What's the tone? What's the feeling? I think what you're pointing to is very instructive, that listening requires not just simply listening, but making sure the other person has heard you. So you didn't feel heard, even though they claim they listened, they heard what you had to say. And so when you're in a situation, when you're in their shoes, and you have the power, and you're maybe in a group of people who are outvoting the dissenter, perhaps then you can learn to listen to the other person, say the dissenter, and say, oh, I realize we're voting against your wishes here, but let me make sure that I understood what you wanted before we, and kind of so they really feel heard, and take that time. And what to do about your dilemma, you know, I don't know if I want to give advice, but if you model how to practice with dissenters, maybe other people will learn. Remember once in our Sangha meeting, and when we were doing the work of incorporation as a community, as a non-profit, there were times when that whole process of coming up with bylaws and deciding the nature of our community was a little bit contentious among different points of view. And there was one point where everyone who was part of the committee, except for one, wanted things a certain way. And there was one person who was very strongly opposed to how the great majority wanted to go. And finally the person the dissenter was willing to step aside. So it wasn't exactly a vote, it was kind of like a consensus basis, but one of the ways consensus works is the dissenter will step aside. And so it looked like we had a decision. And then what the committee decided was, it was the end of a long evening, people were really exhausted, and we finally gotten what we wanted was, you know, this vote to go ahead and with how we want, you know, the thing. But it felt wrong to make that decision at the end of a heated evening when everyone was tired. when this person kind of exhaustion had been willing to step aside. So the committee said, okay, this is great, but let's not make the decision until our next meeting. Let's bring this up again in the next meeting, and then let everyone sit on it for a week or two, and then let's see what happens then. Yes?
As far as the listening thing, I think the emphasis for me has always been different. And I know when I was taking communication.
Talking about that situation where you were comfortable with silence, mm-hmm. What is it about that silence that talks and makes us uncomfortable?
That's a great question. Why don't you all, anybody who wants, kind of give some possibilities? It's a range of possibilities. Why are we uncomfortable with silence in conversation? Silence implies you're wrong.
We're uncomfortable with uncertainty.
Uncomfortable with uncertainty. Yes.
I think there's something thinking about silence that can be sort of embarrassing. Unless you're with somebody who's been doing this.
So it's too intimate.
And sometimes by using silence, it can make whatever was said just before then have too much meaning. In a way.
So if we allow silence to occur, then what was just said just before that can seem like it has too much meaning. Maybe like we agree or we don't agree in some powerful way. Yeah.
Maybe when I try to think back to when I felt uncomfortable with silence in conversation, and what's come to me is that when I feel when there's
something. Communicated the content, but the meaning of the joy and happiness of what the teacher was teaching was found in listening part from everything else, from the body language, from the expression. So listening isn't just the words.
That's right. My early 20, I think, I was living in an apartment building, as a college student, and there was a balcony in front of the living room. And I was out in the balcony one day, and the sliding glass window doors were closed. And so I was standing in the balcony, I was looking back through the glass doors into the living room, where two of my friends were having a very passionate conversation. And I couldn't hear a word of what they were saying. And I was so fascinated by how much was being communicated between them that it had nothing to do with the words. If I had been able to hear the words, I would maybe have seen the body language and the passion and the joy and the excitement and the... So a lot goes on. So thank you. That was sweet to hear all that. So may you all learn something new about your ability to listen this week. Thank you.